Welcome to the Educause Podcast. You can find more podcasts like this at www.educause.edu/podcasts. You can also subscribe to our iTunes feed by searching for Educause. On this podcast, we present a panel discussion from the 2009 Midwest Regional Conference. The panel discussion is entitled Community Dialogue, Best Practices, Emerging Trends, and Views of the Future.
Now I'm going to introduce our panelists, and then I'm going to ask them to stand when I go through individually and introduce them. Dennis Cromwell. Okay. Dennis, stay standing. Dennis, the Associate Vice President for Enterprise Infrastructure, manages critical technology infrastructure, including data centers, servers, storage, campus networks, telephone switches, identity management, cable and wiring at Indiana University. Thanks, Dennis. Dennis will be handling the managing enterprise resources, best practices, and architecture and implementation track. Kathy Lang. Kathy's the Chief Information Officer at Marquette University, responsible for the strategic direction of technology and the coordination of computing and information systems, including operational management for technology infrastructure, project management applications, and support services. Kathy's track is IT service management models in higher ed. Ed Van Gemmert. Ed is the Deputy Director and Associate Director for Public Services at University of Wisconsin-Madison, provides leadership at 16 libraries for the general library system at UW-Madison, participates on key academic, technology, budget, and policy groups at the university. Thank you, Ed. His track is Building Information Services Together, Emerging Practices for Library and IT Collaborations to Advance the Institutional Mission. Andrea Nixon. Andrea is the Director of Curricular and Research Support at Carleton College. Andrea is responsible for coordinating curricular and research support across academic departments, curricular initiatives, and support units campus-wide. Engages community and research projects that inform the creation and refinement of an integrated curriculum support model. And her track is Emerging Practices, the Intersection of Teaching, Learning, and Technology. We thought we'd start. I'm going to stay up here and moderate from up here, but most of the activity is going to be with the panelists. But we thought we'd start and give you some framing to this conversation that's going to unfold today. So this conference really has been designed to be inclusive of everyone. That was our goal. Basically, we all know now at this point that we are in this service deployment together at our universities, and so we tried to create a program that really was embracing of everyone and inclusive of everyone. I hope we hit the mark for all of you. This assumes we're all working together within what we're calling at our institution a series of service layers. We liberally lifted some ideas from Brad Wheeler at Indiana University. So some of the language, some of you have heard Brad talk or will recognize some of the language, but we tried to put it in a form that was a little more comprehensive in terms of each of the roles that you may be playing. The diagram basically has in the gold section, what we call leverage services, and those for which we achieve the greatest economies of scale through standardization. The area on the edges, the reddish color on the edges is considered edge services, which we describe as being more specialized for unique needs and should be delivered closer to the faculty member, especially at the local level. So the pyramid goes core at the bottom, up to more specialized at the top, and the lower cost per unit of service at the bottom because of scalability and a higher cost per unit of service as you get near the top. Just briefly go through these, not all of them, but you'll see breaks in the lines in between the service layers. That is intentional, is because there is bleeding and interaction between the different layers all the way from the top all the way to the bottom. And so if you start at the bottom, you have your greatest two commodities, which really are power cooling, fire suppression, which is a commodity, and telecom and network services, which you will see very little of that we envision should be done by edge services. In our case, with telecom and networking, the only edge services are our auxiliaries, like our bookstore, our union, and so on. We have a history being retail operations of doing this work. You move up to the middle, you see enterprise messaging, storage, content management. We believe most of that should be leveraged, and that very little of that really is at the edge, that the edge services for that really are in the connections with faculty and staff for utilizing those technologies. And as you move to the top, research cyber infrastructure, for example, we view as something that's mostly an edge service. However, there are things like data centers, power cooling, system administration that we think scale a lot better centrally, and that the computer scientists really should be located closer to the faculty and so on. So the concept there, and of course on top of everything, is why we're here in the blue area, the teachers, the learners, the researchers, and the support staff. So that keep this in mind for the rest of the framing. And so I'm going to ask, what is your primary role at your institution? And so we have another clicker session. And so why don't you start to respond to one of those five? Beautiful. So we see mostly that about a third of the people are in the leverage IT support services, a smaller amount, about 9% in libraries, and you can see rest of you where you fall in. So again, this useful information about knowing who's in the room and how you view your primary role. One more slide, and then we'll begin to turn over to the panelists. And that's, does this model of leveraging an edge make sense? And read it carefully. You may have gotten the idea, we are a little irreverent at our institution, we like to have fun. Now, if this number in the last one tracks to the number of staff I have here, I'm going to be really upset. All right, this one's taking longer. You're having trouble with this one. Okay, we've settled in on 152 now. See, we knew we needed to ask that last question. So, that's good. I expected there'd be a certain amount of ambiguity. I think this is something we're going to have to continue to talk about over and over, because this is one of the areas, those of you who are at my table talking about centralized, decentralized technology, this is a conversation we're going to continue to need to have. And I want to talk to those 22% at the end. So I'm going to turn it over to Dennis Cromwell, and Dennis will prompt me when I should start a session. And Dennis, why don't you get started?
As one might imagine, I went through the managing enterprise resources. I went through the managing enterprise resources track, and so in the whole discussion of leverage or centralization and edge components, managing enterprise resources tended to fit more in leverage resources, as you might imagine. And I want to say, as I went through the fairly broad set of presentations there were several themes that I thought was part of that, and I'll ask anybody to comment if you pick up any other themes. First of all, I want to say that there was a lot of, certainly a great deal of emphasis on metrics throughout all the presentations. And I think in comparison to some of my first foray in higher education conferences where no one brought data, it really is a tremendous difference that we really all track data. It becomes important what we measure, how we measure, and determining the success and failure. And I think that as an IT practice, we've grown up in 20 years, and that's certainly a tremendous credit to everybody in the room. And so that was certainly one of the things that we picked up. Security and compliance. I mean, not only were there several sessions all about security and compliance, security became a part of a number of items, and I think those of us in the IT profession, that always continues to be a primary focus for us. We worry about security, and we've got the whole issues of whether it's state compliances, whether it's data exposure laws, whether it's laws on accessibility that we've got to manage and deal with our websites, that we're processing through those. Along with that, new technology clearly was a theme, particularly as we deal with the enterprise and enterprise resources. New technologies, and that's that we really are facing a changing role. And not just new technologies. I mean, think about all of you here, and if you were at this conference 2 years ago, had you even heard of Twitter? And where we go and where our students are, and how do we deliver technologies to the point of where our students are going to be in 3 or 4 years and make sure that those are relevant. I think those are an important item. And then changing methods about as we deliver and manage resources and applications, we have a lot of methods that change. And we're all about trying to deliver the most services, the best service, the highest quality, and to change fast and rapidly. And how do we address all those and do the things that were most important? And you know, throughout the presentations and throughout the conference, there is this elephant in the room. If you haven't noticed, we're kind of in tough economic times. And the whole issue of budget and how that's going to impact where we're going. And I think it was real important that through the presentations, I didn't hear anybody use the are we hunkering down? Let's just wait until all this pass over. Let's not spend money. Everyone was thinking about how strategically we position the institutions and how information technology can be strategic. Yes, we know we've got to save money. Yes, we know our budgets are going to be impacted. But let's not stop, because if we do, we as an institution or we as a profession we're in, you know, certainly are not going to be where we need to be. But clearly the elephant was there, and we all recognized it, and I think that was good. Any other comments? People that attend? How many people attended a lot of the enterprise resource sessions? Okay, so there was a few there. Any other comments did you want to make? Anything that I missed to pick up? Now that I have my microphone, not my click. What I did want to know, Bruce, was that an indictment of you or just the CIOs in general in the room? I think it's the latter, actually. So
it depends on how many of my staff actually filled that out.
So I've got a couple of questions that I would like for you to respond to, and so we can get to the first one. In thinking about the leverage and the edge and the trust model, and we didn't really talk about trust. My boss, Brad Wheeler, talks about the fact, rather than frame this as central and decentral, we've done it as leveraged and edge, and the whole idea is building the right trust relationships that allow us to continue. And so in thinking about security and compliance, I think there's a tendency to, is number one, are we addressed, should security and compliance, it's a completely a leverage problem. It needs to be addressed from the top down. It's a security compliance program. We don't have time to deal with any of this leverage trust, number one. Number two, the leverage edge trust model is a perfect fit for security compliance because there's things that happen at the edge, thing that happens at the in the middle. And then the last one is compliance and security. It's just another way for that central IT organization to enforce unnecessary control in the organization. So,
okay,
let's go.
So, start in. Actually, I forgot to tell my staff I'm monitoring their responses.
I know some of your staff, and I don't think it would matter.
You're absolutely correct. All right, so we're at 135. Keep it coming. Okay, that's it.
Wow, so almost split 50-50 by thinking that this is important and serious, and then 10% people out here that just, we got to work on the trust factor in that part. I think that's good. Any comments about security and compliance? Is somebody just really frightened? I'm scared.
Alternatively, if you don't want to go to the mics, then you can use your best voice, and then Dennis can repeat the question.
Okay.
Yeah, over on that side.
Meaning? Yeah, more. One of the things I thought in trying to fit the model is that compliance is itself giving definition to trust. I mean, isn't that what all compliance is all about, is adding some more specificity around the whole area of how you deal with trust. The next question, which one of the things that I was struck in thinking about new methodologies in development, and whether that's looking at community source and agile methods and some of the other functions, is that we're in an interesting area about an enterprise application space. So I've got kind of three questions. You know, where do you think you best describe the application development or the enterprise application space? We really have unprecedented choices now. Ability to deliver robust solutions and on time and budget, more so than ever before. Number two, still no silver bullet. It all needs time, it needs funds, and the skills are even greater than it's ever been to deliver our applications. And then three, which is really in between. Fundamentally, it's the same business we've been in for 20 years. We make continual improvements. There's nothing, you know, we have new technology, we have new methods, but nothing has really fundamentally changed. And by the way, the fourth option would have been, can we get this guy to shut up and move on? But I decided I'm not as brave as Bruce.
Okay, responses are coming in.
There's a lot of pessimistic people in this room today. Anybody here that kind of dealt with the in the 7% that want to argue that we're far better off today than we've ever been? Yeah, we haven't really even talked about the whole idea of cloud and where does it come into play, and certainly in the next the coming years, that's going to make some big difference about giving different kind of choices out at the edge.
Go ahead.
I wonder if you
could flash the world. Right. That's true. And I realize as putting the questions together that, you know, it is hard sometimes to deal with. I think you're right. They're all true, and it's probably a continuum, and it depends on where we are and what applications we're in. But I agree. And so I think we will exercise number four, which is it's time for this guy to shut up and move on.
Okay. Thanks, Dennis. We tried to simulate starting lower in the base, basically, with the order of the sessions. So next one up is Kathy Lang, Marquette University.
And can you hear me all right? Start with that. And hopefully it won't fall off. When I did the service management track, and when I think of service management, I think of it as a philosophy for how we operate IT, how we basically provide those services to our user community. So, and there are a lot of philosophies, there are a lot of different models and frameworks to provide those different services. So I thought I would start out with a question. And the first one is, what is your IT service management philosophy? One being ITIL-based, some other specific philosophy-based, COBIT or an ISO standard, just standardized processes, or what is an IT service management philosophy?
Okay, there were a lot of responses to that one, so I think number four, I'm going to guess.
Very good. Okay. That's interesting. Okay, and it's interesting because ITIL, there were a couple sessions specifically on ITIL, so it's interesting to see where we are using standardized processing as compared to, say, some of the other industries. The next thing, when you think about service management and how you provide support to the campus, there's often questions about how do we do it? Do we do it centralized model? Is it decentralized? Is it federated? And by federated, I mean kind of a combination of both. With maybe some tie into the centralized structure. So that's my second question that I'd like to see your response on.
And I'll just mention the go button is on the clicker for those of you who are fidgeters. So you have something to press, don't press it. All you have to do is put in the number.
Okay, so what model do you feel is most effective in providing services? Is it centralized, decentralized, or federated?
Okay, 156.7 responses, so that's highest number.
That's kind of what I figured. A lot of places have a little of both. When I went to a lot of these sessions, they were quite diverse also. I mean, obviously all surrounding a service management theme, but very different types of sessions, from very general to very specific. So what I did is looked at these, and really some common themes came out in most of those presentations. And those three common themes are standards, training and documentation, and communication. So I'm just going to briefly go through some of the points that I heard repeated again and again in some of those presentations. First of all, with regard to standards, everything from standard policies, processes, a common language base, standard tools, etc. And I heard, standards are necessary for everything from mitigating risks and ensuring proper internal controls to just reducing the duplication of effort in providing these services. Also, there were some ways in which these standards were either selected or determined, and that was, first of all, most people said you determine which ones to use by assessment, assessing your current status, looking at what you're currently doing, looking at where you want to go, and then choosing a standard or a standard process or tool or whatever it might be to fit that approach. And another thing that was noted is, and really it came across in the first question, that there isn't necessarily one standard framework or model or approach that works best for everyone. And the key is to pick one that works for your organization, modified as need be, but just stick with that, because the end result is improved service, more effective service to the user community, and just picking any one could get you the results that you're looking for. Let's see, it was also mentioned several times the importance of common processes across campuses, even some of the areas that had decentralized services, the importance of using maybe a common tool set, common terminology again, and common tools like a help desk system that both centralized and decentralized support services use. That came out a number of times. Also mentioned that that the standard processes should drive any tool selections versus picking a tool first and then adapting your processes to meet the tool. The second item was the training and documentation. This came out numerous times, how important it is to document the standards that you have, document the processes that you have. That's a great tool for your staff, and train your staff on those processes and make sure that they understand that common terminology, because you want the staff all being able to provide good service. So providing that training for them is critical, even on an ongoing basis. And also another thing that was brought up a few times is the cultural change. Sometimes when you're moving to a different service management model or changing processes, it requires somewhat of a culture change, which is very important to have the training so people know that helps with that changing of the culture. Which kind of really leads into the third one, which is probably the most important, and that's communication. As with most things, communication is really the key to implementing any service management type system. It's very important also for changing culture if you need to do that. People need to understand what's in it for me, how does this work, what's the benefit for the rest of the campus, and they need to understand how the users perceive that service, how they can, how to best deliver it, and how the users can get what they need. We're moving back from a culture where IT's sitting in the back in front of a monitor, to being much more out there, being much more collaborative. It requires that mutual trust and respect. And communication is probably the key to making all that happen, to building that trust and building that respect. And as more and more collaboration occurs, it's very important to have the right communication so that people do collaborate effectively. So I guess in summary, I just want to say I think the goal of IT service management is to provide those effective IT services, in a timely manner, where and when the users need them. And three common themes that came out of the presentations on this track were the standard, using standards, processes, policies, tools, etc. And then accurate training and documentation, and then most importantly, the communication. Does anyone have any questions, or anyone who went to the sessions, was there something else that you picked up that I missed?
Uh, I'm going to call on people randomly. Come on, someone. So everything about service management is perfectly clear?
Got it all. Well, and that's one of the key reasons, I think, why you implement service management. It really does come down, in my opinion, from a cost-saving perspective, because what I found, we've implemented ITIL a number of years ago, and I believe that we really do provide better services. I believe we have fewer outages. I believe that the users are getting better service today, which ultimately, in turn, relates to productivity enhancements. I don't need to add staff to provide the same or more level of service.
At the pre-conference seminar, the CIOs got together, and we had a chief business officer there, and we were talking about basically the investment model for IT and how, in fact, some investments really are necessary because there's an upfront cost, but the returns are downstream. And I think IT service management is, as Eric was saying, it, you know, you have to be able to decide, are you willing to make that investment, which is really obviously tough during times like this right now. Other comments or yes?
Was there any discussion about how the service management can help build trust with the rest of the organization? In other words, that can be helpful in the parties.
That wasn't specifically addressed. He asked if there was any discussion about how service management can improve that trust. But I think inherently it does, because if the users know what to expect and they get that same service time and time again, it builds that trust and respect.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy. Next up, Ed Van Gemmert.
Good morning. How's the audio okay? What's that? Okay. I'm not sure which way to point. So if you hit a direction on the clicker in the direction of the compass, I will turn that in that direction. So I'm a first-time EDUCAUSE attendee, and I intend to convey to my library colleagues when I get back that you've put together a lot of good content for us librarians, and I really have appreciated the conference. I also I want to particularly thank the 24 presenters in the library IT track, collaboration track, which is the track that I attended. Each did a great job presenting their ideas and raising a lot of discussion. And I also want to thank Bruce from UW-Milwaukee for inviting me to share some summary comments from that track with you. Some of the key principles that emerged from the library IT track are that strategic partnerships between the library and information technology are obviously vital to our institutions. With budgets as they are today, institutions are not only looking to make reductions, but also seeking growth and development areas for reinvestment that deliver high value to the institution. Whether or not we offer blended services, the outcomes of the cooperative projects must align with the institution's academic mission. Our conversation today has changed from centralized or decentralized services to what are our common or shared goals and outcomes. Now is the time for innovative thinking and action. As was mentioned before in Dennis's remarks, if we take a defensive crouch, a back-to-basics position, we will not retain the support of our institutions. From a user's perspective, they often see siloed units, no easy access to services, redundant services, undeveloped or underdeveloped learning spaces, and uncoordinated web and application support. But there are opportunities for change that emerged at this conference. For example, determined and persistent leadership is required to better define roles and establish clear memoranda of understanding. Trust and mutual respect is crucial to successful blended projects and teams. Joel Cooper from Carleton College referred to this as a committed relationship. Our discussions today center on common or shared agendas. Librarians and instructional technologists in particular should work more closely together on team-based projects. And examples of some of those successful strategic opportunities that emerged include the planning and development of the creative use of new space or the repurposing of existing space. It's interesting, I think, with all the, we measure at Wisconsin, we measure the use of electronic resources today in tens of millions per year, and yet the use of space remains at the top of the list in terms of a priority for students in the administration in terms of redevelopment. Our gate counts at the libraries, we've had a 15% increase. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. Although the use of print materials has been reduced, our gate counts are up 15% over previous years. We have more people coming into our libraries, and I'm sure Wisconsin isn't the only place. We have more people coming into our libraries than attend all of our athletic events in total. Now, years ago, Wisconsin didn't have a great athletic turnout, but today we're a little better. Anyway. So the use of space and the repurposing of that space. Secondly, the planning, development, and implementation of consolidated or merged customer services areas for the purpose of improved customer services and the elimination of duplication and confusion. I think we're going to see a lot more of this development as time goes on. It should be noted that more institutions are using knowledge bases as at these public service areas as well. Librarians have a lot of distrust about knowledge bases in general, but more and more are in use. Successful collaboration acknowledges real cultural and social differences between library and IT staff. But regardless, decisions are made to move ahead strategically on projects that add value to the university's academic mission. And finally, successful collaborations also include effective assessment and measurement of customer satisfaction. User-focused decisions regarding resource allocation are based on data derived from assessment. Very good programs I attended. That's a very quick summary. I think I hit most of the major points, but I'd welcome any additions that I might have missed.
We still have time after your slides.
Let's look at the questions. So there's no right answer here, folks. But I'm interested in some of the areas that we encounter where we might look for some logical connections between IT and the libraries. Libraries have oftentimes been traditionally aligned with the arts and humanities community, oftentimes seen as the laboratory for arts and humanities. Libraries, we have a difficult time with the big science, with the storage problems and whatnot. Space is obviously an area where we've already done work together, and there's more that we could do. We could spend a lot of time talking about the intricacies of scholarly communications and what it means. Everything from the creation of the research to the collection of the material to the storage and to the publishing. And then I'm sure there are other areas as well. So,
I think you're having trouble deciding here.
Pick your poison. That's a good question. It could be either. Certainly, it's needed on. I'm sorry. The question was: is it physical space or cyberspace? Libraries need help with both, and I think our institutions need help with both. When I composed the question, I was thinking physical space to answer the question directly, but. I can see where you would think about it as virtual space as well. Many librarians see number four, the scholarly communications, as a huge area of development on campuses today. Question? So the question is about course management systems and whether we collectively have done that already, whether we've put course integrated content, library related content, electronic resources, etc., e-reserves into those course management systems. Course management systems actually are related in a way to number four. There are copyright issues involved there. There's publishing issues involved there. There's fair use issues involved there. I see more and more IT folks on our campus wanting to get into that number four area. I don't mean to. I don't have an answer to your question, by the way. We're struggling with it. I know at Wisconsin.
How about comments from others?
Yes, there's a. Yeah, it really does. I had that same sort of phenomena too. My struggle is that I've been a librarian for too long, and so I view myself solidly on the academic side of the house, and my perception is that IT is more on the administrative side of the house. Now I know that's not true. I mean I know it's not true, but so these trust issues come into play, and I know that in my own circumstance, there are people in this room that I've worked with on projects that have kept the user in mind and the outcome in mind, and they've worked out well, and we've worked together, and the outcome has been very successful. So, but I don't know if it's true with big campuses or little campuses or what's at play there, but that sort of the trust issue between the academic side and the administrative side, I think, might be one of the smaller elephants in the room.
Do you think do you think the combining of the sessions where we purposefully tried to bring IT and libraries together was beneficial? Okay, good.
There was an argument that it would be, we might have more librarians come to EDUCAUSE if there were a separate librarian track, and actually I would argue against that. I really think we've gone way beyond that. In fact, just to carry that just a little bit further, We've got folks coming out of the library school who go to work for the Division of Information Technology, or who go back and get degrees in. So yeah, I mean there's certain, and vice versa. We're in the library side. We're hiring more individuals who do not necessarily have library degrees, for our own technology, for our own library technology, we've got folks who are on the IT side. It's very helpful. Well, I know you're not. I know you're not. But it illustrates where we've come, I think, that not too long ago, libraries would never consider hiring folks without an MLS. And that's just not the case today. Absolutely.
And could you repeat that, Ed?
Absolutely. So a gentleman makes the point that you can get a library degree today without ever taking a traditional reference or cataloging or an indexing course, and only take courses in a track on information sciences, which is absolutely true.
Yes. Go ahead.
In circumstances where the library and IT have either merged or come closer together, have you seen any changes on the IT side as a result?
The question is, and I can't answer a question because I'm not from an institution that's done that, but the question is, in institutions where there has been a merger of IT and libraries, has there been noticeable changes on the IT side? And what have those been? Positive, negative? I can only speak from what people have talked to me about. I know in our state, in Wisconsin, some of the, what I refer to as some of the smaller 2 and 4 year campuses have merged IT and library. And so practical things like purchasing and allocation of resources is more balanced. But I don't know about the application side. I just don't know.
I work at a library, a university, where the instructional media is part of the library. And with nighttime, librarians have a hard time with the prices of hardware versus the prices of books. This is just a reality that I've been fighting for years.
So there's the inflationary costs that libraries have to deal with all the time. 8, 9, 10% increases.
But in this case, what I'm talking about is a $10,000 unit used by hundreds of people versus a book. Nowadays, it sits on the shelf. Two or three people take it out.
Okay.
Question number two.
Question two.
There's more, Bruce.
Yep.
I know you're anxious for me to sit down, and I will soon. But with a focus on user needs, what's the most effective model, if there is an effective model, for a library IT collaboration at your institution? Some of the things that we've been talking about at this conference are shared strategic partnerships, more traditional distinct roles, hybrid models, or other.
Okay, thanks, Ed. And now we're getting into the home stretch with Andrea at the top of the pyramid.
I'm cognizant. I'm between you and your travel adventure, so I'll be concise. I have to say the teaching and learning track was really strong at this gathering, and I've talked to a number of others who attended. We were in the Camelot room for a day, a couple of days, and it was a really good experience. I wanted to talk a little bit about the types of conversations that we are engaging in and relate that to the ideas that Bruce shared with us. I have been going to EDUCAUSE, the annual, the regionals, ELI, NLII before that, and some of the patterns that I've seen over the years involve discussions, for example, for those of us who are institutional scouts, those of us who are scouring either the open source or commercial marketplaces, trying to identify emerging technologies for our institutions. There was a great example of a presentation from Northwestern Ohio about that, about faculty members who had created wikis and were sharing tools, and that was a good example of that. Another class of discussion had to do with implementation and introductions. So introducing technologies to our campuses, to members of our communities, and helping them identify things that are appropriate for programs of study, for individual courses, for individual assignments, and implementing tools so that they're robust and reliable for our community. And these are some common themes, I think, that are shared in other tracks as well. The third type of conversation I was really excited to see as healthy as it was at this gathering, which has to do with discussions that are informed by educational research and assessment. And I thought that was really strong, and it came in two flavors. One was we had outside scholars come in and tell us about research that was driven by their scholarly fields, which was really interesting. We had a community of inquiry session in which we were talking about an instrument that had been created to look at engagement in online courses. What I was most excited about is the type of assessment and educational research that's going on in this community. And Purdue and the University of Minnesota gave a series of presentations that were really first rate. And I think that is a way in which we're all talking about metrics in one way or another. But I think that there are some really important opportunities. Many of the conversations focused on quantitative forms of research. We're doing a lot of survey work. I also want to encourage us to think about some of the qualitative, some ethnographic research methods that we might engage in. And I think that there are some really important sources there. Drawing from the library world, talking about a way of how library scholarship has influenced the way that we're working at Carleton, Nancy Fried Foster from the University of Rochester and Susan Gibbons have put together a work on studying students that is a great resource. And if you're interested in other resources in that area, I'd be glad to speak with any of you. We've had some great experiences adapting Foster and Gibbons' work at Carleton, and I know the folks at the University of Minnesota have as well. And part of that leads me back to Bruce's theme, actually. So what we're doing is, and others as well, are looking at ways that we can interview students, faculty members, people who are academic support professionals from a variety of fields. And then we're coming together to analyze these case studies. And it is an amazing opportunity for people, whether you talk in terms of leverage and edge or centralized or decentralized or centralized and in academic departments, wherever people reside, They have really important insights into ways that we can connect to students, to ways we can connect to faculty members. And that kind of research methodology, as well as the kind of more traditional survey work that many of us are engaged in, is just a great opportunity to bridge those conversations. And I think it's very powerful. So I was just thrilled to see that in the program. And we were able to read the proposals, and the presentations were even stronger than the proposals. So I was thrilled to see that. Are there any other observations that you would like to make, those of you, many of us, who were in the Camelot?
Yes.
Please.
What I saw in this was that the pedagogy and assessment issues and discussions around the active learning spaces, the creation of info commons from traditional classrooms, were the same that were occurring in the virtual world. And it's kind of the same discussion that was going online with the adoption of the web world. And it was just, these are all kind of coming together in some respect, mm-hmm. that we just have to always continually look at pedagogy, and we always have to look at assessment. But it always seems if you've got a good instructor with decent content talking with students, you get a good result.
That's a good point. I mean, I think a lot of these conversations, they're really useful, and they keep driving home. You know, we're all dedicated. We work in higher ed because we care about it, right? We're dedicated to the missions of our institutions. And these kinds of conversations just pull us back into that. This kind of research and assessment really, really do that. I wanted to get a sense from the audience about who of us are engaged in this kind of work. All of the schools that presented were public research universities that were doing research, and I thought that was really interesting. I know others of us are engaged in this kind of research, but first I want to start out with this and get a sense of how often do you believe your institution engages in assessment or educational research as a means of informing the allocation of resources that support teaching and learning? And by resources, I'm thinking it could be staff time, it could be investments in information sources, resources, tools, designing spaces.
Need to add Jeopardy music next time. Okay.
That's really interesting. Those of you involved in it as a continuous process, what kind of institutions are you from? Small school. Is it a distributed endeavor or is it centralized? Yeah. Any others?
Can I ask him for an example of a resource allocation decision that was a type of decision that might be based on assessment of your institution?
Specifically, I can think of, you know, specifically the library in terms of what they're purchasing. I know that those decisions are informed by the results of our assessment and the institution research area as well. And it's also my goal as the CIO to push that for my team as well, so that we're constantly working on the academic side of the house to make sure that we're aligned with the work there. And the only way we get that information is through the assessment.
That's good. Excellent. I also wanted to, and I alluded to this earlier, I wanted to get a sense of what types of institutions are engaged in this. I realize that there are multiple, the distribution of those of us attending this conference will skew this a little bit, but it'll just give us a general sense. Of those institutions engaged in such projects, by that I mean assessment and educational research, what's your institution's basic Carnegie classification? That's one of the classifications.
Yeah, you're struggling with this one.
What? You'll find someone special.
Okay, I'm gonna give you I'm gonna give you 2 seconds. And now they start rolling in. Okay.
That's fascinating. I think that there are tremendous opportunities for us as a community to begin sharing methods, techniques, as well as our findings in sessions like this. Find ways of collecting data, engaging our communities in research that can really help us be more closely aligned with those educational missions, particularly, I mean, if you think about the resources that those of us in this room are responsible for allocating, it's really impressive. So I think that there's some great work that we could be doing here as a community. Any questions? Okay.
So we're... Thank you, Andrea. Now we're at the point where anything is fair game at this point for questions. And if you call them up from your table, I'll try and repeat them. So any final questions, and I want to make sure don't bolt at the end of this because we have a few final comments. Go ahead, Pete.
Hi, I wanted to see if maybe we could have a Twitter conversation. How many people were either Twittering or monitoring the Twitter stream from this conference? And a lot of hands came up.
And that, by the way, is Kayak Pete.
Yeah, thank you. How many people found that to be valuable? How many found it to be a pain or not useful or...
Or annoying.
Wow. That's interesting. Anybody have comments? What's your good takeaway from Twitter, from the conference? Yeah.
I feel that now I can go back later, look through these comments, anything that I missed either because I wasn't at a session or maybe I was at a session, but I'm listening to something that if I missed a comment, I missed a little tidbit, a little nugget, I could get it because there were about 2 or 3 at minimum I would say in each one of the conferences I was in.
Twitter is a search engine, and people talk a lot about that in the blogosphere, and I agree with you. As a matter of fact, I was, and a lot of people were Twittering mundane things. It's like, well, why did you Twitter that, or that's, you know, that's boring or whatever, but next week or next month, you're going to be able to hit that, dig it up, and get the buzzword out of it, and that is incredibly powerful. What else? Yeah. I made new friends too. And that's part of what EDUCAUSE is about, especially Midwest. It's getting together and collaborating with your peers. I think Twitter was an enabler for that. I totally agree with you. Yeah. What else? Got to turn around and get this side. Yeah.
But I also think there are other things that other people are doing. Like, yeah, we're doing that, and this is how it works. So I want to go back and see what was happening.
As a feedback tool, I think EDUCAUSE is going to be able to learn a lot about how the conference went or how the conference didn't go by looking back at that Twitter stream and saying, oh, well, people like this, and people, it is an awesome feedback tool. You're right, it's great.
I was actually going to ask a question of the audience, and that is, should EDUCAUSE be taking advantage of the tweet stream from the conference? And if so, how should it do so?
Yeah, I'm really worried that we've all gotten together and we've all built this little Twitter community, and then we're all going to go our separate ways and the community is going to fall apart. So some of you started following me. I'm not sure if I decided to follow you. I have my own Twitter community. Do I want to expand it or not? And I think that's a common thing with Twitter is, you know, how are you going to use it? Is it a gigantic worldwide chat room, or is this a small group of friends, or whatever? So it'll be interesting to see. Davenport University, where I work, we have a Twitter channel, so to speak, and we now are up to 500 followers. We use it to communicate with our students and to market the university, and it seems to be successful. It's still an experiment for us, so I look forward to it.
Yeah, question over here.
Yeah.
To not be offended, because they weren't going to allow you to follow them because they said that, in their words, they were going to go dark after the conference on Twitter. They weren't necessarily going to accept every single person that wanted to follow them.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Absolutely, yeah.
We did talk about this with the program committee EDUCAUSE staff briefly about that there'll be a period where we'll need to assess, you know, what happened here. This has been some of the most prolific twittering I've seen. In fact, at one point, I think we got up to number 6 in terms of the level of activity on Midwest Regional Conference 09. There are more questions? Go ahead.
Bothered me or not went through my mind is that I don't know whether a larger conference could handle that. What I found very much similar to you is I would have almost liked to have four tags or five tags, let's say, to follow, because as I watched the search, I was distracted. Like, well, I'd like to just follow what was in this session, and to go to a larger conference where there are several thousand people might just be too much for my mind.
I think that's neat. If a conference were to set up some Twitter ground rules and say, you know, we're going to use these channels for the conference, those sort of built. As a matter of fact, the folks in Camelot started tagging their stuff Camelot, some of them did. So you could actually follow the Camelot content separately if you wanted to. Not all of us followed that rule, so it didn't really work. So I ended up, yeah. I mean, it really, some sessions, you know, there'd be a couple of good sessions, all of a sudden the stream would be going crazy. So, yeah, it's really good. Any other comments?
And if I'm interpreting correctly, some of the interest on the part of EDUCAUSE really is to see what kind of structure perhaps should be placed in around this and so on, because right now it just is kind of sprung up in the wild. It's a lot like a lot of Web 2.0 stuff. It just, boom, it's on you. Yes.
Did anybody feel that maybe the Twitter back channel here prevented people from speaking up out loud in the session, that we were all texting about it, and so therefore we weren't raising our hand and having a conversation?
So we saw some nods yes on that.
Yeah, sometimes I think it feels like I'm passing notes in class or I'm talking in the back of the classroom. I mean, that's what it was when I was in school. But when I was passing notes or talking in the back of the class, I was talking about, you know, how cute she was or where the party's going to be after school. But we're passing notes about the content, so it's a little different. But it would be fun to get RL, real life, and the, you know, the cyberspace, the two to merge closer together. Maybe to have somebody say, hey, somebody just said, you know, has this question, or take a little extra effort to bring that into real life. Because we communicate face to face much better than we do in little 96 letter, you know, tweets.
Repeat that, would you, Pete?
So you're saying to bring the stream right up into the presentation, drop it up, put it right up here on the screen. I don't know. I mean, that's starting to remind me of web conferencing, you know.
Yep, we actually tried something like that, if I'm not mistaken, at the ECAR session while exploring Second Life and showing some of the commenting that was going on, and there were a lot of channels going at one time on that. So possibly, Mary Alice, you had a comment.
I probably can be heard quite well without that. Thank you. Couple of things. We've done a similar type of thing at the Desire to Learn Fusion Conference, where we actually had screens going where we were doing texting and twittering and who knows what else. We were doing it all, and they were projecting it. It was phenomenal. I really enjoyed it. But my comment is that if we're going to be utilizing this technology at these conferences, then please provide us a place that supports the internet better and gives us some power. I put my laptop away because I've used it today, and now I'm down to 30 minutes.
Yeah, and that's some of the feedback that we're always looking for. There's been a theme on that. At the National Conference, they have the power stations that have come up, and so I think we're going to be making note of that when we debrief on each one of these. Each one of these, we're trying some new things, and it's an adaptation, really, from year to year. So we appreciate, and again, it's a plug for fill out your evaluations. Those evaluations are read. They're taken seriously. We want this to be a great experience. One of the things I think we need to do next year is we maybe need to let some of the speakers know that people are going to be twittering. I'm not so sure that we actually let them know well enough at this one. And the first, when it's first happening, it can be a little disconcerting. So each step we pay attention, look at what we're learning, and then we move along. Andrea?
I noticed that people tended to Twitter more in lecture formats, and that the more active the sessions, the fewer the tweets. And I wonder if we might mix up our presentation styles as well. I think tweets are a good complement to the lecture, but we're not going to do that.
Okay. And I think there's a few more comments over here.
Yeah.
We didn't make it to some of the pre-conference stuff, but was there any sort of formal or informal session to introduce people who had never used Twitter before or some of the best practices with it?
There was a handout.
There were handouts, so just kind of a paper telling you, because I think that would be pretty useful. And some people who might not really be wanting to experiment it, to sit down and actually see how people are using it from some of the people who've been involved with Twitter for a longer period of time,
yeah.
I guess would be my suggestion.
Yeah, and I think, again, all this is really good feedback for us to analyze, to take in, and so on. I think maybe one more question, and then I know you want to get going, and we're kind of in between you and your safe travel, so if there's maybe one more, otherwise I'll just close right now at this point.
Great.
Okay, thanks, Pete. Pete also is responsible for inviting one of his faculty colleagues to come here, and it was very enjoyable being able to sit down at a table with a faculty member. I hope we can continue, all of us, to try and encourage our faculty colleagues, those of you who are faculty. It makes a richer experience for all of us having you here, because that's really why we're here. So to close, we start out the conference with pretty broad vision from President Zimpfer, and a little intimidating vision, actually, but to set the stage for the conference. And the conference unfolded with the multiple tracks, which basically talked about the intersections between all of us, the theme of how we're all in this together, that there's certain things that each of us does, and we want to continuously improve. We want to move through commonly accepted practices, best practices, that we want to embrace emerging practices and so on. And then we close this conference purposefully with summations of the different sessions and using the clicker technology. I also want to thank Turning Point for having come here and provided us with the clickers. We really want to make sure you provide feedback about that. Was that at all beneficial to try and encourage active participation and so on? Once more, I want to thank and have stand our four closing panelists.
Community dialogue, best practices, emerging trends, and views of the future. A panel discussion from the EDUCAUSE 2009 Midwest Regional Conference. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.